Is that better? Okay. I'd like to welcome everyone to this presentation on development of North American Arctic gas. I think by the size of the turnout, we can see that this is clearly the right time for this discussion. And I think we have two excellent speakers who can tell us about different aspects of the development process going on. We've put biographies of the two speakers out in the back, so I won't waste a lot of time going through their background. But this is certainly a key question and has been a key question for many years. When I began my career with the Department of Energy about 30 years ago, the first assignment I had was to work on a study to do the selection for the route for an Alaska natural gas transportation system. So I'm glad that things are continuing forward, and hopefully by the time I retire, there will actually be one built. So, but anyway, welcome everyone, and I would like to go ahead and get started in the presentation. We will take both presentations and then take some questions afterwards, and I'll moderate those questions. And then finally, for the press that's here, we will do, after the question period, a small get-together with the press if you have questions you'd like to ask as well. Our first speaker is Brendan Ball, who is Minister for Industry, Tourism, and Investment in the Nova Scotia, Northwest Territories. He's been in the Assembly since 1999. Was recently elected and appointed as the Minister, first Justice and now Minister of Industry. Do you hold both jobs now? Or just both jobs? Okay. Two jobs. So I think that he can bring a special insight into the development of the pipeline systems that are being discussed to bring Mackenzie Delta gas down into the North American natural gas market. So, Mr. Bell.
Am I coming through okay? Okay, good. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I appreciate that kind introduction. About the next 20 minutes, I'm going to talk about Arctic natural gas, and more importantly, I think for you in the room, I'm going to make three arguments as to why you want to see this Arctic natural gas brought to your doorstep and brought as quickly as possible. And as indicated, I'll be available to take questions after the presentation, but let's get started. First of all, this is about as basic as it gets. We bring Arctic gas to your doorstep. It's going to result in lower utility bills for everybody here, and I think that's who in the room isn't interested in lower gas bills. Secondly, probably Americans know this better than most these days, security is paramount, and Canada is a safe and secure, reliable supplier, much more so than I believe some of your other options. And thirdly, whether we like it or not, climate change is a reality today. Natural gas can be a part of that climate change solution, specifically as it helps us reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And so I will get to each of these three elements in turn, but first, I want to take you to the Arctic. Somebody in my office has figured out how to use Google Earth, and so now you're gonna see all about that. The West, you know well, Alaska, right there in the middle of the Northwest Territories, that's my home. Large landmass, almost twice the size of Texas, with very few people. About 40,000 people live in the Northwest Territories. Those two lakes you can see, Great Bear and Great Slave, are 8th and 10th largest freshwater lakes in the world, respectively. Got some photos of the Canadian North. Vast, beautiful land, very few people. Much more energy resources than we'll ever be able to use for ourselves. But we're faced with a dilemma. Northerners are on the front lines of climate change. We're impacted first, we're impacted hardest, and yet we're the source of so few of those emissions that are contributing to the problem. And so Northerners are now asking ourselves whether our development of our natural gas resources can be a good thing for the environment, whether or not it can be, in fact, a part of a climate change solution. And thankfully, the answer I'm here to tell you today is yes. And even better than that, for you, we can lower your utility bills and we can provide you with a safe and secure supply of natural gas. Let's get to economics first, because if we're going to make a major dent in your utility bills, we're going to need to bring a lot of gas. So how much gas are we talking about? Back to the Northwest Territories in the Beaufort Delta, home to some 9 trillion cubic feet of proven reserves, some nice new finds further inland, albeit smaller. The big prize is the Beaufort Sea, thought to contain 55 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. In fact, the entire Canadian North, our National Energy Board tells us, ultimate potential of over 100 trillion cubic feet of gas. If we go west to Alaska, a story you probably know a little better, 35 trillion cubic feet of proven reserves, well over 100 trillion cubic feet still to be found in Alaska. And although there's been much more drilling and activity here in Alaska than compared to the Canadian North, it's still relatively very little activity if you compare that to southern, more mature basins like the Gulf of Mexico. Now, currently in the Northwest Territories, some of you will be aware, we've got something called the Mackenzie Gas Project winding its way through the regulatory phase. These are the project proponents here. I think you'll recognize most of those names, the usual suspects, except for down here. I guess I shouldn't get too close to that thing. Down there is a logo you won't recognize, and that's the Aboriginal Pipeline Group. That's a consortium of Aboriginal interests that have taken a one-third ownership stake in this project. The Mackenzie Valley Pipeline will bring 6 trillion cubic feet of natural gas initially from Inuvik. You can see there down into the Alberta system and on into southern markets. And forgive me, when I say southern markets, I mean lower 48. It's all relative. And off to the west, you know the discussion over the last number of years about bringing Prudhoe Bay reserves of natural gas to market. And I want to note the good work of Drew Pierce in seeing this project move forward. And of course, Governor Palin now doing some work to try to make sure that this project becomes a reality and we're able to bring this natural gas to the lower 48. These two projects combined have the potential to bring 8 billion cubic feet of natural gas a day to lower 48 markets. And that's important because if we look here at the natural gas demand, the projections go forward in the U.S. annual demand over the next 20 years, we're going to go from 22 TCF to potentially up to 30 TCF a year, depending, of course, on price projections. Obviously, with lower prices, we see more natural gas demand. And so that's great. But what does that mean for Americans? What does that mean for the average homeowner? Well, we're doing some work to try to better understand that ourselves. And we're working with an organization called Energy and Environmental Analysis out of Virginia. They've done some modeling for us. They look at various different scenarios, and we've asked them to put together, and I'll talk a little bit more about this modeling later, but we asked them to do a comparison of Arctic gas coming to market and what that would mean for consumers in America and Canada. And so we started with a base case called the Arctic gas case. That sees the Mackenzie Valley project built, followed a few years later by Alaska. And it also analyzes significant LNG volumes coming onshore from Russia and from Norway. And then we contrast that with the no Arctic gas case. I'm locked up here. There we go. And in this case, Mackenzie's never built. Alaska reserves are not brought to market. And we see only limited LNG arrivals from Russia and from Norway. So what are the impacts of this scenario on North American consumers? Well, they're quite dramatic, as we found. Additional costs to U.S. consumers between 2014 and 2025 of almost $300 billion if we're unable to bring this Alaskan gas to market. In Canada, about $40 billion. If you're interested in more detail on the modeling, obviously I won't have enough time to get into that in this speech, but I'll provide you a link, and you can go on and have a look at the scenarios that were analyzed. Now, some would argue that, all right, if Arctic gas isn't brought to market, we'll simply look to other sources of supply to make up that shortfall. And that's where I think it's important to start talking about security of supply. I think most know that Canada is third in the world in terms of natural gas production, eighth in terms of oil. By far, our biggest export customer is the United States. Because of agreements like NAFTA and some other bilateral agreements, we enjoy something called a fully integrated energy market. And that's important. Because as the weather comes, as the storm comes, as they did in summer of 2005, and we see supply disruptions, Canada is able to increase production in order to offset that supply shortage. In this case, it was in the Gulf of Mexico. That's important. Outside of North America, the picture is not the same. And we know that much of the world's energy resources are housed in regions of political instability. Yeah. And on top of that, we've got developing economies that are increasing their demand for those same resources that we so desperately need. So I would argue that security of supply is going to be more important, not less, as we move forward. If a country's prepared to change its constitution to extend the term of its leader, it's likely not too worried about changing the terms of commercial contracts. Even in friendly countries today, we know that even in friendly countries, the world is becoming more and more a dangerous place. But what then of domestic nuclear, of ethanol and biodiesel, Gulf of Mexico, natural gas supplies, or even coal? There's a lot of coal in the United States. Aren't these viable alternatives to Arctic gas? Let's deal with each of these. Nuclear power industry. In 1986, The Economist magazine declared that it was safe as a chocolate factory. But I think you know intuitively, and our energy mix will show us in the United States, that it's been essentially flat over the last number of years. It has just never overcome significant public resistance in this country. Ethanol, well, seemingly a boon for transportation fuels, but not going to do much for us in terms of electricity. And even as a transport fuel, some drawbacks, competing with food for land, an uncertain energy gain, potentially raising input costs, feed costs to farmers, then passed on to consumers, and maybe most troubling of all, still dependent on subsidies to make its way to market. Gulf of Mexico, long been the supplier of natural gas needs in the lower 48, but we're having to go farther offshore to find that gas now and drill deeper and more expensive wells. And I think as the supply disruptions occur, as the price spikes happen, it reinforces for us that I think it doesn't make any sense to have all of our eggs in one basin, if you will. Coal. Some would argue this is all the security we'll ever need. It's here. It's ours. It's plentiful. Yes, there is an absolute huge volume of coal in the United States, and 90% of it is used to generate electricity. I would argue, though, that with twice the emissions of natural gas, the environmental consequences of using more coal make for a poor trade-off, especially as you compare it to natural gas. So each of these fuels has been promoted at one time or another by one group or another as the answer to our energy challenge. But none can do it alone, and none can do it without at least some significant drawbacks. Arctic gas, as I've mentioned, will lower your gas prices. It will come from a secure supply. But maybe most promising is the potential impact it can have on helping us lower GHG emissions and the resulting positive effects that can have for our planet. I want to turn to that now. Very few would argue that climate change today is occurring, and I think we seek to better understand the effects that people are having on that climate change. But that it's happening, I think, is not in dispute, and scientists tell us that it will continue to happen. In the North, we're seeing the pace of this change faster than anywhere else. If you've read this summer, our Arctic ice pack is at its smallest level ever. Our wildlife are being affected. Our caribou are struggling to deal with increased rainfall, decreased snowfall, and the effect that that's having on their ability to get to their food source. Our Aboriginal elders are telling us they've never seen weather patterns like this before. And maybe most troubling for our environment, potentially, is the melting of our permafrost. We tend to focus on CO2 emissions, but there's a lot of methane tied up in that permafrost. And as it melts, it has the potential to be 21 times more damaging to the environment. First, there's a lot of it. And secondly, I think you know it's very effective at preventing heat from escaping back into the atmosphere. If you're interested in this formation, it's called a pingo, found in the North. I know there are a few in Alaska, found in Canada as well. It's essentially an ice heave in the permafrost underground, but we're even seeing evidence of these melting too. So Northerners are starting to ask ourselves what we can do about climate change. And I had the opportunity recently to meet with your former Vice President Gore to talk briefly about that. I've invited him to come north to see firsthand the impacts that climate change are having on our people, on our environment. And I have to say, he hasn't taken me up on my offer yet, but I remain optimistic. I'm hoping that I didn't lose him when I proposed we wanted to save the planet by building pipelines. I'm sure that's it's probably not something he hears every day. But back to the question, what can Northerners do about climate change? Well, I think we can do two things. First, we have to develop adaptation measures that will help maintain our roads, keep them stable, our houses permanent, our infrastructure secure, even as our permafrost regime is changing around us. And secondly, I would argue that we need to bring as much natural gas as possible to the lower 48 so that as your energy demands increase and your need for more electricity increases, you can use more natural gas in meeting that demand. I think that's important. This, interestingly, is a picture from Alaska. We found it on the internet, and I have to admit that's not home, but not my home. This is not where I invited Al to come visit. John Holdren at Harvard has developed a simple formula that I think really helps to illustrate the challenge we are facing. Carbon emissions, a function of the number of people times the GDP per person times the energy required to produce that GDP times the carbon intensity of the fuel we're using to power our growth. Well, population, we can't do much about that. But thankfully, it's not growing as quickly as we had once projected. It's good news. GDP per person, this is a good thing, and we want to see people elevate their standard of living. Energy, then, required to produce that GDP. Well, even in countries like China, we're now seeing less energy is required to produce the same output as compared to even a few years ago. But it's this last factor, the carbon intensity of the fuels we're choosing to power our growth. This is the cause of some great concern. In other countries around the world, we are seeing a move to less carbon-intense fuels. See the share that nuclear makes up in France. In Britain, lots more natural gas being used today. In Korea, a combination of nuclear and natural gas. In fact, I think Korea is second in the world in terms of LNG imports today. But in the United States, coal is still the preferred fuel of choice. As I mentioned, twice the emissions of natural gas. And admittedly and thankfully, there's some good work going on here in terms of coal and better understanding how to capture and store those emissions. But the science is not yet proven. We're not sure about the long-term implications for the storage, and we're not sure as to whether or not it can be competitive or cost-effective at this point. So I would argue that at this juncture anyway, it makes sense to use as much natural gas as we can in fueling that demand. Interestingly, we also asked the EEA, in addition to the economic analysis and work that they were doing, to look at carbon emissions and the effect that it would have on the lower 48 and on Canada if we're unable to bring Arctic gas to market. The conclusions of that red band, some 258 million additional tons of carbon emissions in the U.S. between 2014 and 2025 if we're unable to bring Arctic gas supplies to market. So where does that leave us? Well, our continental energy dilemma is a combination of insufficient domestic supplies, high and volatile world prices, uncertain foreign suppliers, and on top of all that, now we've got to deal with increasing GHG emissions and the impact that that's having on our planet. It would be wonderful if there was a magic silver bullet solution to all of our energy challenges, but we know that that's not the case. Instead, I would suggest that our two countries, Canada and the United States, are going to have to work together to identify a range of options. And in doing that, I think we need to focus on economics and on action, not on moral suasion. It's not enough anymore to suggest that people turn out the lights as they leave the room. The problem is too big, and it's going to require a suitably big solution. For corporations, we hope that morality is important, but it isn't always determinative. And I think few of us would expect that companies are going to ignore their bottom line in order to pursue environmental goals. So I would suggest that if society and governments want to pursue the goals of generating economic benefit, having a secure supply of natural gas and some environmental impact limits, then we're going to need to focus on the numbers. We're going to need to demonstrate clear benefits. Here then again are the numbers. Arctic natural gas can save North American consumers some $338 billion between 2014 and 2025. That's got to have an impact on the average homeowner in the United States. We'll also save 280 million tons of carbon reductions. Orders of magnitude. In order to get something like this back, you'd have to, shut down California for a couple of years. And there may be people in this part of the country that would say, all right, go ahead. But certainly I'm not here to propose that. So this is pretty significant. And I think as we focus on solutions, we've got to be taking a measured approach. We've got to be pragmatic about this. Now, we in the room may never be able to do anything about whether Russian and Norwegian LNG finds its way to our shores, but Arctic natural gas in Alaska and in Canada, well, That's under our control. That's right in our backyard. And if we want to see this natural gas find its way to market, there are some things that governments can be doing. I think I'm going to propose three things here that I would suggest governments need to take a look at. First, help reduce the cost of shipping gas through these pipelines, either by insisting on the unbundling of production and transmission, or delinking of those two elements, or in the case of producer-built pipelines, making sure that there's a fair and equitable application of tolls and tariffs to all gas, and that there are appeal mechanisms built in should commercial terms, commercial agreements escape would-be producers from those who own the pipeline. I think only if we create basin-opening projects are we going to see enough gas volume brought to the lower 48 to see it competitive. Secondly, I think we've got to provide policy direction to our regulatory agencies. Yes, regulatory reviews need to be thorough, but they must also be responsive to our energy needs. And the open-ended timeframes that we've seen in some projects aren't acceptable. And thirdly, I would suggest that our two countries need to work together. We've done it before, but we can work on developing our joint energy resources together for the common good of our two countries. A good example of this in the past was the Columbia River Treaty. But this time around, I think it's imperative that we take some action. We could strike a joint task force on northern pipelines to help ensure that we see continental energy security as it relates to natural gas on this continent. Arctic natural gas, I would propose, can be a viable and vital part of any energy solution for Canada and for the United States. And on top of that, I think as I've demonstrated, I hope as I've demonstrated, it can have a positive impact on our planet as well. So just in summary, when it comes to Arctic natural gas, we can lower your gas bills, your utility bills. It makes economic sense. Secondly, it makes sense from a security of supply perspective, and this is more and more critical in this day and age. And thirdly and lastly, I think it helps us address a fundamental environmental imperative. Thank you. Here's the web link if anybody's interested in seeing the research that was done, the work that's been done by EEA. The modeling is quite fascinating, quite technical. But hydrocarbon supply models combined with some natural gas data from around the country makes for very interesting reading, I assure you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Minister, for it was an excellent presentation. We'll turn now, once we can get you queued up, to Drew Pearce, who brings to this discussion an extensive background and experience on many aspects of the issues. She has served in the Alaska government, both in the State House and the Senate. Has also served with the Department of the Interior before being appointed into a new job as the federal coordinator for the Alaska Gas Transportation Projects. Is that the right terminology now for it? And I think that she can help us understand what the status is for the development of the Alaska gas resources and what may play out in the near future. So please, and we'll see if we can get you queued up here.
I appreciate the invitation to be here to talk to you about my favorite topic, Arctic gas, the Alaska gas pipeline, and bringing Alaska's Arctic gas to the markets. I look at this not as an Alaska project, but as a North American project. And so the fact that I'm on the podium today with my good friend of many years and Canadian ally and closest neighbor shows how much the two countries working together hope to bring environmentally positive natural gas to lower 48 markets from our own Arctic gas, like Brendan said, that we control. Nope, that didn't work. Okay. Proven world gas reserves. You can just look at where these reserves are and see very quickly how important the energy security question of the natural gas picture is. The gas is in places and countries that have proven to sometimes be close allies and friends, most often not. U.S. Has, and Canada, as you can see in the north, do have natural gas reserves, and we certainly hope that we can bring those to markets because they provide economic stability, they provide an energy supply for the future, and they do provide that energy security that's so important as the world is changing. I said this isn't just an Alaska project, and one of the problems that we face as Alaskans is the fact that people talk about the Alaska gas line and they think, well, gee, any profits from the gas line are only going to go to Alaskans, and that's not true. The customers are the folks in the lower 48 if the pipeline comes down the Alaska Highway, if the markets are in the lower 48. So the actual consumers in the lower 48 and some consumers along the pipeline in Canada are the actual beneficiaries of our Arctic gas. And there's a lot of gas to be discovered. This project isn't just bringing that 35 TCF to market. This actually opens a huge basin for further exploration and development. As you can see, we've got discovered 35 TCF, undiscovered conventional resources onshore, about 72 TCF, offshore, 97 TCF. So we've got over 200 TCF of gas in Arctic Alaska that could be drained using a pipeline coming from the North Slope to the lower 48. And if you, after I speak, if you want to look at the map, what you'll see is the Prudhoe Bay area, where most of the gas that has been discovered actually sits, is sitting on state land. The state lands have been mostly explored, and of course, Prudhoe Bay, Kuparik, Endicott, and Lisburn, and all the other fields are producing. The gas is being reinjected. The Point Thompson field, sitting just to the east at the edge of state lands and at the edge of ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, holds another 7 more or less TCF of gas that has not been developed, along with a lot of gas liquids. Most of the future gas, the onshore 72 TCF and the offshore 97 TCF that is expected to be discovered as conventional resources, sits on federal lands, either in NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska to the west, in ANWR to the east, or offshore in the OCS. That doesn't mean that Alaska's lands aren't important, and there is exploration that continues on Alaska's lands, but most of the gas that we expect to find in this basin and produce belongs to all of us. It's Americans' gas. It's not just on state lands. That's a point that most people in the lower 48, frankly, don't understand. They don't have any understanding of who owns which parts of Alaska and where the conventional reserves are expected to be found. The non-conventional resources are exciting, too. Coal bed, methane, 44 TCF, gas hydrate in place, 42, gas hydrate in place, 60, and undiscovered hydrate in place, as much as 560 TCF expected in Alaska. So the opportunities for energy supplies coming from northern Alaska, from the Arctic, and also from the Canadian Arctic are not endless, but certainly are huge and important to bring to the lower 48. As I said, it's basin opening. In the past, no one has looked for gas on the North Slope of Alaska. Finding gas was sometimes an afterthought. It was definitely a nuisance because there was nowhere to go with it, no market, no place to put it, so it has to be reinjected. And the actual gas has been a limiting factor in production in the Prudhoe Bay field and has been a source of difficulty for producing other fields in Alaska. We are finally beginning to see some companies come up and actually begin to look for gas. And that's because the entire markets for gas for the lower 48 have become so important, and it is clear to companies that there is a lot of resource to be found in the Arctic, particularly our Arctic. Anadarko will be drilling, we hope, the first gas wells this winter. Conoco may be drilling some wells around one of their fields that could are in probably a gas trend. Other companies have come to the state, new companies. Shell, of course, is offshore. They're looking for oil, but also have clearly said that they're looking for gas. Those resources in the areas that I'm talking about, with the exception of Anadarko, all belong, are all in federal areas. The pipeline that we would build to bring gas from the North Slope of Alaska to the lower 48 is unprecedented in size and scope. It's approximately, if it comes down the highway, 450% longer than the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It has international boundary crossings, obviously, and will need cross-border coordination. It's much bigger under anybody's plans than a typical large diameter transmission pipeline. Some companies have said that they're looking at a 48-inch line. The producers actually had some projections that they might use 52-inch line. And we would expect it to be entirely buried along the route, except at certain river crossings. This is a map that shows the potential pipeline if it came down the highway. And I say if because there's no certainty that the Alaska Highway Project is the one that will actually be finally built. There are also companies that are looking at bringing a project to both the state and to FERC for permitting and licensing that would be an LNG project. The LNG project would come down the same route as TAPS to Valdez and then export. The gas would then sail out of Valdez, either to come to North American markets or to be exported. But if a project comes down the highway and comes through Canada, as you can see, it is a huge project, 2,100 miles from the North Slope down to Alberta, and another 1,500 to get gas from Alberta to the markets, although we don't think that we'll need to build more pipelines because there is going to be excess capacity in the pre-build from Alberta south. So the 2,100 miles of pipeline to get North Slope gas to Alberta is the project that we would be focusing on as the federal coordinator's office if the project comes down the highway. Congress, all the way back in 1976, after Prudhoe Bay was, or TAPS was being built, startup of TAPS was in 77. In 1976, federal legislation was passed here in Washington that authorized pipeline. The project was not developed at the time due to the high cost and insufficient economics for the natural gas. The Department of Interior issued a right-of-way in 1980 for a highway pipeline, and ANCS is now owned exclusively by TransCanada. So those old rights for that right-of-way are now held by TransCanada. In 2004, interest had resumed in bringing North Slope and Arctic gas to markets. The McKinsey project was already being discussed and, in fact, moving forward. I think the joint process had either started or was very close to starting. So Congress was, through their own initiative, but also working with the producers and with the state of Alaska, brought forward legislation that established my office, the Office of the Federal Coordinator. It says that the old ANCTA certificate is valid if a project comes in under that ANCTA certificate, but an application could also come in under the Gas Act. There cannot be an over-the-top route. Congress has banned linking our Arctic gas by pipeline across the top of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the Yukon's park that is also a wilderness area over to the Mackenzie and coming down the Mackenzie. Congress said that or decreed that the public need and the downstream capacity for this pipeline is presumed. There's a loan guarantee program for a project that brings gas to the lower 48 markets, $18 billion, up to $18 billion loan guarantee. Department of Energy is supposed to complete an alternative construction study to present to Congress so that if an application doesn't come forward within an amount of time that, frankly, we're already past, but there is movement, Congress will have an opportunity to look at what next or what else might they do. FERC was to do open season rules, which they completed on time, and they are the lead environmental agency and will complete an EIS in an 18-month period after a completed application is on their desk. There were also tax provisions at the same time, accelerated depreciation for the pipeline, and an enhanced oil recovery tax credit. The federal coordinator's office was one of the first things for startup, but things, of course, don't move quickly when the president is going through a nomination process. So while I was actually nominated by the president on June 9th of 2006, I was confirmed by the Senate on August 3rd, 2006, which was warp time for the U.S. Senate, sworn in by the vice president in December of last year, and I head the Office of the Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. The functions and authorities of the old Office of the Federal Inspector, which was created under the 1976 provisions of law, have transferred to me, and I would have all of those authorities should an application come in under the old ANCTA. I am supposed to, with my staff, ensure the expeditious discharge and compliance of all related activities by the federal agencies as a pipeline is being permitted, and then as it's being constructed. We are supposed to ensure that there are expedited reviews and actions. We can prohibit certain terms and conditions if agencies are going beyond their regulatory norms, and we can actually prohibit certain actions. I also have primary surveillance and monitoring responsibility of the project on federal and private lands. We will work with FERC. They will use their pre-filing process to facilitate a pre-application dialogue between the stakeholders, including all of our permitting agencies. We will assist FERC in expedited review by the agencies in ensuring that there is expedited review. There is an interagency agreement that's already in place that calls for the coordination of NEPA and historic preservation reviews for interstate pipelines. We also have a federal interagency MOU that we signed in June of 2006 that's specific to the implementation of this project that includes all the participating departments, and here they are. It's a little scary to look at the number of federal agencies that believe that they have a role and responsibility in permitting this project, but there they are, and there's why we need someone to help coordinate and try to expedite. And I must say that when you look at a cross-border pipeline, thinking of all of our federal agencies trying to interact with our sister and brother Canadian agencies, the opportunities for confusion are immense. But these are the federal agencies that have a role in permitting this huge project. And here's just a summary of some of the actual permits and approvals that would be necessary. I talked about the interdepartmental MOU. It establishes a project management framework for cooperation amongst the agencies. And all the participating agencies have agreed to use their best efforts to achieve early coordination and compliance with deadlines and procedures that each will establish. We're planning with uncertainties, however. and that makes this somewhat difficult in that there is no project application either under ANCTA nor under the new act. FERC doesn't have an application in hand. All eyes have been on the state of Alaska on this pipeline project for about 36 months now. There was a proposed contract that then Governor Murkowski took to the legislature in 2006. The legislature did not accept the contract, did not approve it when he brought it. And during the process of special sessions to try to get the legislature to approve the contract, there was also a massive change to the oil and gas tax regimes in Alaska, and the state went to a PPT system. That did pass. The governor lost his primary. A new governor was elected. The legislature acted at least independently of the governor and refused to accept the contract that was in the place, and the new governor, Governor Palin, was elected and took office in December of last year amidst all of that, which was rather chaotic legislatively. And then as a new governor, also has been dealt the hand of a lot of investigations, FBI charges and federal indictments and charges, and a trial that's actually starting in Alaska today in which some former legislators are accused of taking bribes in order to vote certain ways on the changes to the tax regime. So everything that happens in Alaska right now by the legislature and by the governor in terms of a gas pipeline, anything to do with the oil industry, is being looked at with under a microscope. The governor chose to set aside the old contract and move forward with a different process. We could argue all day long whether that was right, whether it was wrong, but it's a decision she made, and she had some good reasons for doing so, one of which was on Election Day, when Alaskans were polled, the majority of Alaskans believed that something called the All Alaska Project, which is the project that has been brought forward by the Port Authority Group, which is an LNG project bringing in a smaller line, bringing about a billion BCF a day of gas from the North Slope down to Valdez and exporting, was the best project for Alaskans. In order to have the state citizens of Alaska accept anything else, there needed to be some sort of open process, transparent process, whereby Alaskans could look at the different projects and see what the benefits, pros and cons of each one were. So what the governor has put on the table and what the legislature passed during last session was something called a GIA, the Gas Line Inducement Act. And the GIA put in place a process whereby there will be applications that come forward to the state for some company to receive, some entity to receive a license from the state of Alaska, whereby the two of them partner together to bring applications to the federal government to build a project. A GIA does not require that there be lower 48 delivery of the gas. That was not one of the requirements. A GIA has requirements that are for the state. It's not a federal law, it's a state law. So what the governor was doing was putting in place the absolutes that the state was going to require in order to allow permitting at the state level of a project. The I can run through some of the companies that are at least talking about perhaps bringing in an application. The timing of application, the request for applications went up on the website on July, I think it was the night of the 2nd, 3rd, which was the time frame that the governor had laid out. The applications are due back to the state at the end of November of this year. The state hopes to select an applicant to take to the legislature for approval. And I believe that it's actually February now, since they pushed back the application timing a bit. The Alaska legislature does have to approve any licensing by the state under AGEA, and there are some specific requirements as and commitments that would be made by the companies as they come in with these applications. There, we know some companies that have made it clear that they are planning to come to the table with applications. We know other companies that have made it clear that they are not. And I'll start with the are nots. Enbridge has said that they will not be coming with an application, a conforming application to the state. MidAmerica, TransCanada have said that they will be coming with applications. We would expect both of those to be highway projects. The Port Authority plans to come with an application. Theirs will be some sort of an LNG project. I don't know the size, and I'm not sure what their expectation is for where they're going to land their gas. There's also been interest on the part of the Chinese, of Repsol, of British Gas, to have come in to with perhaps with applications. In all of those cases, the expectation is that we would be looking at LNG projects. As I said, the state's process does not guarantee lower 48 delivery. So there's a big question if a company comes in with an LNG project that would ship, export the gas to the Pacific Rim, what would Congress do? And Congress hasn't faced that question. They haven't asked each other that question, but we don't know what they might do in that case. And I also don't know what our friends the Canadians would do. I suspect that they would be knocking on the door of the Energy Committee talking about what the fact that they would like to see a highway project, because the synergies for the Canadians of bringing Alaska gas to market bring local gas to a lot of small towns along the highway, but also would bring gas liquids to the liquids industry in Alberta. It's very important to the Albertans that the project come down the highway. So there is planning with uncertainties. We don't know what sort of a project is going to be brought forth either at the state level or who will actually come to FERC with an application. I deliberately didn't mention the producers. They're sitting together in the second row. Sometimes they don't sit together. Sometimes they do. Probably shouldn't read too much into the fact that they're sitting together today. But the producers did not support AGEA as it passed. They have said, at least two of the companies have said publicly, that they will not be bringing forward a conforming proposal. There is some question about whether or not the producers might bring forward a non-conforming proposal, and the governor has made it clear in the AGEA process that any proposal that comes forward, even if they deem it non-conforming, will be made public. So if a proposal comes forward from the producers, or from anyone else, but from the producers that doesn't conform to the requirements of AGEA, it will be made public. And the people of Alaska and the legislature of Alaska will have an opportunity to look at that, run it through their models, and see whether or not they think the governor chose the best one. As we're facing all of these uncertainties, my office has done two things. We've been just trying to do startup, but working with the state, the governor's team, led by Marty Rutherford, and also Minister Jim Prentice, who has the pipeline files, even though he's changed positions in the government of Canada and in the cabinet, he still has the pipeline files. We have established a senior intergovernmental management team that will be working together to oversee the cooperative efforts between our agencies at the federal levels, but also with the state agencies, to ensure that we have all the right all of the right agreements in place so that we can move forward when an application does come to meet that FERC timeline. That 18-month timeline is very short. I said that under AGEA, people have to make commitments. The company that would be successful under the AGEA process will come in and commit to having an application, a full application to FERC within a timeline. They also will be committing to having to going to open season within a certain timeline, and they also will be explaining in detail if they're planning a highway project, how they expect to get that project permitted on the Canadian side of the border. And that's been a big question in Alaska in the legislature, is how are you going to get through Canada? Watching McKinsey, I think it's fair to say that Alaskans have some skepticism over how quickly that we might see the Canadian side do the permitting for a line. On the other hand, we know that there are lessons learned, and we want to work together through this intergovernmental team, to talk about what we've learned, what they've learned, and how we can make this process go perhaps more swiftly, more efficiently, and more effectively. We are also going to launch in October a gap analysis where we will be looking strategically at the specific agreements, even looking back at the treaties from the old INCTA, looking at what is in place, seeing where we have gaps. Who's forgotten they had roles and responsibilities, or who's forgotten what they had in place back in the 70s? What do we need to make sure we have in place as we move forward? One of the questions that's come up under ANCTA, there is a treaty that's in place. However, if an application doesn't come in under ANCTA and the Canadian Northern Pipeline Act, is there no treaty? And if not, what is in its place? Because that treaty had some very important considerations and agreements and commitments. So the commitment will also be to try to go to field seasons as early as next year. Realistically, we could get to first gas. The earliest realistically we could get to first gas would be 2017. I think that's wildly optimistic. I think we're looking at least 2018, maybe later. Great lead time, a lot of infrastructure to be built, but a project that's extremely important to the consumers in the lower 48, important also to Americans who own much of these resources on our North Slope, important to our neighbors in Canada if the project comes down the pipeline, and important to our energy security and to our economic stability and vitality for the future. When you go to the North Slope of Canada or of Alaska, there are areas where the sun never sets. So a lot of people worked on this project 30 years ago. I hear that all the time. And I suppose you can look at this. It's either the sun rising over this project yet again or the sun setting, but I choose to think that the sun is always going to be high and we're going to get it built. I thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. That was an excellent presentation. And I think we'll keep that visual on the screen there as we go through the questions. So I must admit we had a great number of very excellent visuals to represent the Arctic region through this presentation. In doing the questions and answers, we have a couple rules here at CSIS. The first is if you would identify yourself and your affiliation. And then the second is if you have a question to ask, please make it in the form of a question rather than just using it as a statement. So we really want to take questions if possible. But before we got too far into the questions, I was wondering, Minister Bell, if you would like to update us a little bit on the process for the McKinsey project. Drew had referred to some of the lessons learned, but I think we'd all be interested in where things stand now.
Thank you. Well, I hope we're learning lessons, and I don't know if there are any rules for answers, if I actually have to answer questions.
No, only asking.
The McKenzie project, as I mentioned, is going through the regulatory review phase. Our National Energy Board, which is akin to your FERC, is hearing it. It's been throughout the Northwest Territories, just about all of our communities, to hear from people who had something to offer, concerns, questions, hopes, and aspirations for this project, and we've gone through all of that. The public review phase is now come to an end. Our government has struck an agreement with the producers, something called a socio-economic agreement, that will ensure that there are benefits to Northerners from this project. The federal government has stepped forward with $500 million contribution that once the go decision is made on the project will be spent in some of our smaller communities to help uplift those communities and get them ready for this project. So I think we've got less than a year left now in terms of the regulatory review process for this project. At the end of the day, the producers will have to make a go, no-go decision based on the terms or the conditions put on the permits. We expect optimistic and hopeful that it will be a go decision at the end of the day, but there are some negotiations currently in parallel between the government of Canada and maybe I should have been more clear, and I didn't lay this out at the beginning. I'm with the government of the Northwest Territories, so similar to a state government. Drew was talking about Minister Prentice, who has responsibility for the pipelines from the government of Canada, federal government. So at any rate, the federal government is in negotiations with the producers, and they're looking at some things like accelerated depreciation schedules and some other incentives that can help make the project more economic. We hope that they can come to an agreement, but that is the last real remaining hurdle outside of the regulatory process, is just whether or not the producers will deem this a commercial endeavor. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, questions?
Shirley McCown, please.
My name is Rodney White. I'm from Gas Daily. Sorry about that. I heard neither one of you talk about the point of view of the environmental community, which is, from what I've read, they don't like any of this. How are you going to address that?
You know, I think what tends to get a lot of attention is are the big ENGOs, often headquartered in Washington or in Ottawa. And I think unless you've spent time on the ground in our northern communities and understand the reality of 30-40% unemployment, then you can't really speak with any authority as to what the people of the region are thinking. There are some environmental considerations and questions that have been put forward. I think those have been very well and adequately dealt with through the regulatory review. Obviously, there are many, many permits to be gained, lots of considerations, but we think that we can easily mitigate the environmental potential negative environmental impacts of any development. This is no different than we've treated diamond mining or some of the other things going on in our backyard. So I would take the views of the people on the ground in our territories, our Aboriginal people, over ENGOs headquartered outside of the North that may or may not have ever spent any time there. Thank you.
And I've met with representatives of the environmental community in Alaska, and they, too, are cautiously optimistic that gas line can be built in an environmentally sensitive way. They have not, in fact, they have said that, in general, they are supportive and have not thrown up any specific roadblocks or questions. They want to be part of the process. They want their concerns to be heard. But we have not heard in Alaska a negative outcry about building a gas pipeline.
Hi, I'm Melanie Nakagao with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and I was actually up in the Northwest Territories last year for the Day Cho Watershed Gathering and met with the Dene Ta. And I just wanted to know, my question is twofold. One is, what's the status of the Dene Ta claims regarding consultation? And then secondly, the question of, to what extent will the oil sands prevent some of this natural gas from coming into the United States markets? Because I know there's been some talk about getting this to market, but then once it's to market, there's not much control over where that actually goes. And so my curiosity is, to what extent will the oil sands, which is fueled by the natural gas primarily, will it constrain the amount of natural gas actually makes it to market to the United States? Thanks.
Last question first. All of this gas goes into the Alberta system, and there are customers, it's a very, very complex system, customers at all kinds of takeaway points, delivery points, in between. And so, yes, the oil sands are a potential customer, but there are many, many others. Those who would suggest the oil sands will prevent all this natural gas from getting to market, that's just not reasonable. And if you look at the potential of the North, the Arctic, and in terms of the amount of volume of gas we can deliver to markets, it's really far and away more gas than could be used in the oil sands. Secondly, the oil sands, I think, are recognizing that as gas prices are sufficiently high, it's not making a lot of sense to use natural gas in that operation, and they're looking at other options. Lots of discussion. I don't know if it'll get off the ground, but lots of discussion around nuclear options and other things that might make that recovery of the bitumen more economic. The Dene Taw the first question. Dene Taw are an Alberta band. So if you remember from the map, Alberta, the province below the Northwest Territories, but they their traditional territory is northern Alberta. They make the case and they claim that they have some traditional use areas that go into the NWT. So they stepped up at some point about a year ago or so and suggested that they hadn't been adequately consulted on the development of this project, and we were concerned that this could become a roadblock. But the Government of Canada has sat down with them and negotiated a way forward now. There was some compensation paid. There was some consultation undertaken. And so that potential crisis, I'm thankful to say, has been averted. And I think there, along this road, there have been a number of things that potentially could have been deal stoppers for this project. But one by one, they've all been dealt with or knocked down, and this is another example of that. And I think that it's a testament to the commitment of the Government of Canada to see this project through. Thank you.
I'm Eric Rasmussen with the Energy Information Administration. I have a question about the absence of the two pipelines. A question for the minister. The case analysis you mentioned had an assumption for limited LNG imports as a substitute. I'm just wondering why you think LNG imports would still be limited if neither of the two pipelines are built.
I hope I understand the question. You're talking about the scenarios and the modeling we did. Maybe I'll just explain a little more. And in fact, we have a web link. I know nobody can get to that here, but we do have about 20 or so copies of handouts that outline the research, and they'll be at the back of the room if anybody's interested in picking them up on the way out. They'll do a better job, I think, of explaining this because it is quite technical. But in the first case, EEA looked at a base case or an Arctic gas scenario that saw Mackenzie coming on stream at the end of 2013, beginning of 2014, some 3 years later, Alaska. And then we looked at the realistic amount of LNG coming from Norway and Russia, those projects already in the hopper, if you will, and talked about what that delivery would be. And this was our most realistic, the projection that we worked with them, the most realistic scenario if there's support for these projects. We used that as a base, and then we removed all of those and said, all right, all of the LNG that's currently underway, fine, that'll remain. But any future LNG projects, we'll shelve them. We'll shelve Mackenzie, we'll shelve Alaska. And we ran the comparisons between those two options, both in terms of the price that would result as natural gas comes to market and then also on the emissions and as coal picks up the slack. So those were the two scenarios that we looked at. And the reason for including LNG in the Alaska project was that we felt that this was the most realistic course of events, we hope. And that's why we did the contrast between those two scenarios.
Natural gas prices have been pretty variable, to say the least, in the last few months, years. I'm wondering what kind of a – this is for you, Drew Pierce. What kind of a sustained price on natural gas do you need and delivered prices in the lower 48 do you need to make the project economic regardless of how you set up the project? So I'm assuming there was a unitary investor.
We haven't done any modeling, and I don't actually believe that any of the federal agencies have done any modeling, so I can only go by models that the state used, both the previous administration, the present administration, and the legislature. And trying to remember my numbers. The last modeling that I saw said that an economic line could be built at base prices at lower than $3.50. But that was modeling that was done for the state. As I say, we haven't done any. So you'd have to go back to some of the old Econ 1 models that they were doing.
350 delivered in the U.S.?
Oh, no. Larry, can you help me? I don't remember the Econ 1 numbers. Do you? Larry's from the state of Alaska.
I don't believe they modeled a specific number of what a project would be economic.
No. For a lower 48 price. Okay.
Thank you.
My name's Richard Wallace, no affiliation. You mentioned the U.S. federal reg, I'm not sure the name, but was no over the top, was the description. Could you explain the virtue of that rule?
I am not sure that I want to try to explain the virtue of any Senate decision. There have been some proponents of producing Alaska's North Slope resources through pipelines across the North Slope to the Mackenzie Delta and then coming south for as long as we've had known gas and known oil on the North Slope. Alaskans came to the Alaska delegation and said that they wanted an Alaska project so that they would have some of the benefits of the construction and of long-term jobs. Probably more importantly, Fairbanks and other communities on the pipeline want the ability to draw gas off a line, and South Central Alaska wants the ability to have a spur line to bring gas into South Central, where the Cook Inlet supplies are, the resources are diminishing. The ban of the over the top line was also supported by others, both on the Canadian side of the border and the U.S. side of the border, including Native Alaskans, Native Americans, and also the environmental community that did not want a pipeline permitted across either the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or to try to permit one offshore. And so I don't know which member actually wrote the ban into the legislation, quite honestly, but it's there.
Richard Ranger, API. A question for Minister Bell on Native land claims. Have the First Nations claims in the Northwest Territories portion of the route been resolved satisfactorily? And I guess this would be the case for the Canadian portion through the Yukon and down to Alberta. And the second question would be, does Canada have a provision for a lead agency along the lines of FERC in the U.S. for the Canadian portion of the route?
First, to the land claims question, because it's a little bit complicated. No, not all of the land claims are settled in the Northwest Territories. About half of the groups along the pipeline right away have settled claims, and incidentally, they're also the ones that really have a deal now with the producers. The outstanding claim, primarily the Decho claim, is the one real remain holdout in terms of putting together what we call an access and benefits deal with the producers. There's some good signs there, though, and I think I meet with the Decho leadership frequently, and I speak to people in those communities. They're not by any means against the development. They do see this, though, this project somewhat as a lever in their negotiations with the Government of Canada over their land claim and their self-government aspirations. So I'm confident that there's a business deal there to be had. I know the producers are working quite diligently to try to strike a deal. I don't think this, at the end of the day, will be the biggest hurdle in the project. I'm more concerned, to be quite honest, about the business deal and whether or not that can come together between Canada and the proponents as compared to any of the outstanding access and benefits with First Nations. And as to the lead agency, I'm not sure what, I mean, it depends on what form a project takes, and I'm not sure what the Government of Canada is thinking internally in terms of how they will handle the Canadian portion. And I think Drew has raised the same question, and Americans have a right to know and understand that there's going to be some certainty and some predictability there. obviously we've got to sit down, I think, and have some joint discussions, our two countries, to talk about the way forward and make sure that we draw up a map, learning on the experience that we've had in McKenzie, which is, I would suggest you've got to define time frames for these reviews. They can't drag on indefinitely. Thank you.
If I could just add to that, Minister Prentice has done a masterful job of making it clear that the government is not going to choose at this time between the old Northern Pipeline Act, which would be the TransCanada preferred regime, versus the NEB regime, which I think the producers and perhaps others would prefer. So the government has been unwilling to choose. However, having said that, Minister Prentice has also made it clear that he recognizes that timelines would be useful and perhaps imperative for moving a cross-border project in an efficient manner, particularly with the timelines that are in our federal legislation and the timelines that are going to be in the governor's license if an AGIA project goes forward and it's a highway project. So I know that he's thinking along those lines.
Bill Riley, Foster Natural Gas Report. Question for Drew Pierce. If there's no application under the ANGTA, as you said, there are treaty implications. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
That's part of why we're doing the gap analysis. If there's not an application under the old ANGTA, then the treaty, we are making an assumption before we've done the full legal analysis that the treaty, which was ANGTA-based, perhaps would no longer be in effect, and that would leave perhaps some holes that we will have to figure out how we deal with the Canadians on some of the cross-border issues that were dealt with in the treaty. It's one of the questions that we're facing with all the uncertainty that we have in trying to plan the processes that we're going to use. And so it's one of the things that has come up. It's just one of many questions that have come up that we need to analyze. I don't have any specifics for you, but with the treaties definitely put in the treaty has specifics. If we don't have a treaty, if indeed it's not in place, then what is the next step? And so that's one of the things that we need to analyze. And that's the point of doing the gap analysis, which we're going to be beginning next month.
It's Jim Evstafio with Bloomberg News. No one has mentioned directly the revised cost estimate on the McKenzie project and the industry reaction to that in the past, 6 months or so. Exxon, for one, saying that it might not even be feasible at those numbers. So I guess my question is this a situation where more direct government subsidies are going to be required to get either of these projects built?
The recent cost revisions were not a surprise to see the appreciation in costs. I will admit that I was surprised by the magnitude of the costs and going back through them and better understanding them. A significant portion of that is related to field development. So some of the old numbers that were thrown around of less than half of that, I think, were specifically earmarked to the pipeline. We have now a broader understanding of what the whole development will cost. It's a concern. As I say, if there is the one outstanding issue here that I find troubling, and that is whether or not we can make this project economic. Is the government of Canada prepared to subsidize the energy companies to see this happen? I would suggest that they're not. And I'm not speaking on behalf of the government of Canada, but Minister Prentice has been pretty clear that this project has got to be economic and it's going to stand on its own merits. So I think things like accelerated depreciation treatment, those are all that's an option that's probably on the table. There are other things, I think, that can be done. We've lobbied that, if you were to build this pipeline in southern Canada, it would be cheaper because the infrastructure's in place, the roads, the ports, the runways that are going to be necessary. We've argued a logical role for the government of Canada, which can bring down the cost of this project, is to invest in some of that strategic infrastructure in the north. That would be a wonderful legacy pass the project and also help us to develop our economy further. So there's a negotiation underway. All of these elements are on the table, but direct subsidies to companies, I'm going to suggest that I don't think that that's in the offing.
Thanks. Thank you very much. These are excellent presentations. I'm Frank Ferrastro from CSIS. I have two quick questions. One deals, Drew, with the non-conforming application. Is there a specific, is there guidance on how to handle a non-conforming application if such a thing were put forward? How that's addressed in Alaska? I mean, presumably the reason that you want conforming is because the ground rules are laid out. So what do you do with a non-conforming? And then the second is a bigger issue, and it's more on the kind of business plan. If you start looking ahead to 2015, 2018, and it's actually a follow-up to Eric's question, and you look at U.S. supply and U.S. demand, if the resources are in different places around the world and companies go upstream to invest in country to build gasification facilities or liquefaction facilities and then regas facilities in the United States, what do you do with stranded investment 10 years from now? I mean, there's a timing problem here when you look to fill the gap in demand. Thanks.
To your first question, the governor's process that she's using calls for any non-conforming applications to be made public, and I believe that they'll go up on the website with the conforming applications, but the due diligence will be done on the conforming applications, and a choice of one to take to the legislature will come from those. There's no process in place that I know of, at least not as yet, for what to do with any non-conforming applications. And to the economics, just as Minister Bell said, any North Slope Alaska project, any pipeline, whether it's an LNG project to Valdez with export or even bringing the gas to the lower 48, whether it's a highway project, has to be economic. And the financial markets will, in a large part, make the decision on the go or no-go, whether or not it can be financed. And that's going to be based on the expectations of the prices in the future. It's a huge timeline, which is part of the great risk that all the companies are facing. However, there are definitely companies that are coming forward believing that those risks are acceptable, and we'll see what sort of applications come forward.
In terms of LNG imports, I mean, I think I've long suggested that there is a window for Arctic gas, and it's open now, and that it makes sense to make hay while it's sunny. We don't know in the future what the volume of LNG imports will be on the continent. Obviously, they're not easy to permit. So I think when you look at the future growth in gas demand, there's room for both Arctic gas and for additional LNG. But there's no doubt that that's in the back of our minds, that we better get moving on these projects. We'll see how the permitting goes and the regas facilities happen in the United States. I mean, time will tell, and we'll see if the population gets more and more comfortable with that. But we do see the opportunity now for Arctic gas, and we want to move on that.
Any additional questions? Well, I think I'd like you to join me in thanking Minister Bell and Drew Pierce for their presentations today.
Thank you.
I'm still not assured that I will get to see this Alaska gas pipeline in my working lifetime, but please keep at it. And the same in the Arctic gas. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good. Yeah.